There's been a lot of discussion about how the Cold War ostensibly ended 20 years ago with the fall of the Berlin Wall. For today's backstory segment, we decided to look back at some of the strange and terrifying ideas dreamed up before that by Cold War policymakers. And I'm not just talking about Edward Teller's idea to detonate an atomic bomb on the moon. For example, did you know that the Kennedy administration considered using nuclear explosions to widen the Panama Canal, or that the Soviets actually built a doomsday machine? We're joined now by energy and science writer Alexis Madrigal and by Nicholas Thompson, Wired Magazine senior editor and author of the book The Hawk and the Dove. Welcome to both of you. And Nicholas, we keep on bumping into each other. You were here just a little while ago to talk about The Hawk and the Dove.
Yeah, it's a delight to be back.
I'd like to start off with a clip from Stanley Kubrick's Dr. Strangelove, where Peter Sellers, as the title character, is explaining how a doomsday machine works. Let's take a listen.
But how is it possible for this thing to be triggered automatically and at the same time impossible to untrigger?
Mr. President, it is not only possible, it is essential. That is the whole idea of this machine, you know. Deterrence is the art of producing in the mind of the enemy the fear to attack. And so, because of the automated and irrevocable decision-making process which rules out human meddling, the doomsday machine is terrifying. It's simple to understand and completely credible and convincing.
Gee, I wish we had one of them doomsday machines, Stacy.
Nicholas, you recently wrote about how the Soviets actually did build a doomsday machine that was codenamed Perimeter. How did their machine work? Did it sound like the one that Peter Sellers was describing?
Quite a bit, but with a couple of differences. The point of the Soviet doomsday machine was to make sure they had the capacity to respond if we launched a nuclear attack and blew up the Kremlin defense ministries. So even if
this was in response to Star Wars, to the SDI program?
This is in response to the general fear during the early Reagan years and during the Carter years that the United States was going to launch a first strike. Mm-hmm. And they thought, if the U.S. does launch a first strike, we want to be able to hit them back. And so the way it would work was through a four-step process. Four things have to happen. First, it has to be turned on. So it's off normally, but during a crisis, somebody would turn it on. Secondly, then it senses for whether there has been an American nuclear strike. So that's seismic data, radiation data, pressure data. If there has been a nuclear strike, according to the sensors, then what it does is it tries to send a signal back to the defense ministries. If it can communicate and if it can talk to the defense ministries, then it says, okay, the humans are still alive, I'm going to shut off. If it can't communicate with them, then it says, there's been a strike, there's a crisis, everybody's dead, and then it transfers command authority over the Soviet nuclear arsenal to guys in a bunker who then can launch.
Well, it sounds like they put a lot of safeguards in it.
Yes, there are several safeguards in it. And in fact, my view is that it made the Cold War safer.
I'd like to play another clip. Peter Sellers is Dr. Strangelove. Let's listen to this one.
When you merely wish to bury bombs, there's no limit to the size.
Alexis, the U.S. government also spent a lot of money on examining the subterranean uses of nuclear weapons. Can you tell us what was Project Plowshares?
Sure. Project Plowshare was essentially a project to turn nuclear weapons into actual peaceful aids to civil engineering. So, for example, they wanted to build a harbor in Alaska under Project Chariot that was just essentially going to blow up huge portions of the Alaskan landscape to create a harbor that no one was really sure what to do with. Of course, they had other ideas about what to do with nuclear explosions. One of the best is under Gas Buggy. They were going to actually stimulate natural gas production in Colorado, and they actually tested some of that out and actually tended to work, but the gas was radioactive.
Well, weren't the experts thinking about the environmental consequences of these ideas?
You know, in some ways they were. I think, you have to think about it at the time. And we weren't really sure what safe levels for radioactivity were. And so I think a lot of planners figured that the levels that we'd settle on were higher than the levels that the American public turned out to find acceptable.
Nicholas, the nuclear test ban treaty was ratified around this time, 1963, right. And it only permitted nuclear testing to occur underground. So we're talking about using nuclear bombs to as earth-moving projects. It sounds to me like another way to test nuclear weapons.
That would have, I absolutely can guarantee you that's part of what the thought was. It's why, I mean, there are all sorts of decisions that were made. For example, nuclear energy, the type of fuel used in nuclear energy was used partly because that would be the products that come after that or can be used to make nuclear weapons. So there are all sorts of ways that the nuclear arms race changed and perverted policies.
Was this just something the Kennedy administration had come up with? Didn't it originate with the Eisenhower administration?
Well, there, you know, the plans for
Atoms
nuclear
for Peace, I think it was called, wasn't it?
Well, the plans for using nuclear weapons these different ways are things that surface in every administration. There are all sorts of strategies for how can we use them peacefully. And gradually, over time, they declined. At the beginning, people thought, oh, we can use nuclear weapons for hundreds of interesting things. And then it was sort of dozens and less until at the end we had a terror of nuclear weapons and wouldn't have considered that.
Alexis, the Kennedy administration signed off on at least considering the program, which is, if it were proposed today, would be dismissed by almost everyone as absolute lunacy. Was it actually seen as a viable project at the time?
You know, I think it was. I mean, if you read the old declassified letters from the Atomic Energy Commission to the Kennedy administration, when you see that they actually considered this to be a viable use of thermonuclear explosions, it is pretty amazing to think that we would have thought of doing what they were calling geographic engineering. But I guess if you put it in the context of sort of the types of things that we're considering as kind of last-ditch efforts to battle climate change in terms of geoengineering, it's an even bigger transformation of the globe.
Nicholas, did you, in researching your book, The Hawk and the Dove, find out whether Paul Nitze and George Kennan were even involved in these discussions?
Kennan, absolutely not. Kennan would have stepped back and said, these are the stupidest things I've ever heard. I don't want anything to do with it. My grandfather, Paul Nitze, would have been utterly intrigued. And he had all sorts of interesting game theory ideas that he floated throughout his career. For example, in the 50s, he said, well, what if we set an international policy that you can use nuclear weapons, but only on your own territory? So you can use them to fend off an invader. And then, well, maybe that's not the best idea because then the next people to attack us will go straight to our cities. So then it gets complicated. In the 60s, he says, well, we need to convince the Soviet Union we're going to shoot an atomic bomb in the moment of conflict. How do we do that? Well, maybe we should blow up part of Siberia. Then they'll really know we're going to use it on Moscow.
We're talking about some of the ideas that were floated during the Cold War with Nicholas Thompson and Alexis Madrigal, both with Wired magazine. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate, and I'd like to play a clip from a video produced by the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission on Project Plowshare. Let's take a listen.
Excavations of new harbors, big dams, canals, passes through rugged mountainous terrain. These and other massive, imaginative, earth-moving projects may soon be ours. Created in seconds with the tremendous energy of the peaceful atom. Nuclear explosives for large projects that are simply not feasible with conventional methods and at considerably less expense. Scientists and engineers today are carefully working toward these goals with a series of nuclear excavation experiments designed to increase their knowledge and skills in this exciting new concept. They call their program Plowshare. It is a deliberate, careful, scientific program. Cratering and excavation through the use of nuclear explosives. The peaceful atom, a tool to move a mountain.
Alexis, the announcer talked about peaceful atom. Were nuclear scientists particularly interested in promoting the peaceful lines of their work to the general public, or is this just a way of justifying atomic weapons research?
Well, you know, I think you had a couple different interest groups, I think, certainly within the security establishment, military establishment. You know, you had kind of this provided excellent cover for doing military R&D. But I think the scientists themselves, to a greater or lesser degree, were all involved with the Manhattan Project and knew people who were involved in the Manhattan Project. And some of them pretty explicitly, like, say, Alvin Weinberg, who was head of Oak Ridge National Lab, actually explicitly linked his sort of guilt and feelings about nuclear weapons to peaceful uses of the atom, that they felt like if they could use it to better the world, then that would sort of balance the sort of apocalyptic vision that they'd enabled the world to have with the possibility of nuclear war.
But the program enjoyed a fair amount of bipartisan support, not just the support of people like Edward Teller.
Right. I mean, I think you had a lot of, it was kind of, the lines that determined whether or not you're supporting this kind of research weren't necessarily partisan. A lot of them had to do with, you know, how you felt about, you know, the progress of technology and kind of the social constructions that we have around, you know, the uses of science and the proper uses of science.
Nicholas, in 1960, Herman Kahn published on thermonuclear warfare. How did his theories help change the way policymakers and the general public viewed nuclear weapons?
They did two things. One is, I mean, he had an incredibly rational analysis of nuclear war. If they do this, we can do this. And he had a scale that would go from, you know, low-level nuclear conflict to something called wargasm, which is, you know, ultimate nuclear conflict.
But also wasn't he looking at what would happen if there were a thermonuclear war? How badly damaged would the Soviet Union be in comparison to the United States?
Right.
And he came out with the reassuring thoughts that the United States would come out of one better.
Well, and what's interesting is some people did find it very reassuring, and they thought, you know what? This is a problem we can think through. Man created this problem. We can solve this problem. Let's just take Kahn's thinking and let's go one step further. And there are a lot of people who thought that, and it leads to this whole study of game theory. Other people, utterly repulsed, and it made them even more upset with America's nuclear buildup.
Alexis, on your blog, you've written about a 300-page contingency plan developed by the Postal Service in the event of a nuclear war. What was it supposed to do?
Well, so, you know, all of these government agencies sort of have to figure out ways of translating the risk of nuclear war and kind of visions of nuclear war into actual, like, organizational procedure. So the Postal Service had a plan in which after a nuclear war, you'd fill out an emergency change of address form just so you'd make sure to, you know, continue getting your mail. It's kind of amazing. Judith Miller, like that Judith Miller, 1982, was covering, you know, a congressional hearing on this, and you know, she actually describes the chain of command for the Postal Service moving from Washington to Memphis, and then from Memphis to San Bruno. So they had these incredibly detailed plans, but on the other hand, they hadn't really tested them. They didn't really know if they would work, and in some ways, maybe they were what Lee Clark calls fantasy documents that just kind of help soothe a population and a bureaucracy that can't really deal with thinking about nuclear war.
Well, we, in our schools, we were being told to get underneath our desks as if that would help us in an atomic explosion. The radiation would not really know whether we were under the desks or not. And there are still all sorts of places around town where you see these little signs where people would go into the basement in case there was a nuclear war. In the case of the post office, we have people signing out, filling out address forms for emergency delivery in case there's a war.
Right, right. I mean, and you also had, you know, entire design conferences. You know, like now you have people trying to design for like a low carbon future, and back then they, you know, you'd have urban planners get together and sort of design for the nuclear city, you know, that would have like built-in and kind of fashionable fallout shelters. And I think it's kind of a fascinating human response that some people, when faced with, you know, this nuclear apocalypse, are like, well, actually, I'm going to design like a better, you know, periscope for my bunker, and not like I'm going to try and stop this from happening.
Were the same sorts of things happening in the Soviet Union? Were people talking about megadeaths and coming up with contingency plans and bomb shelters?
They were. One of the very interesting points that's I think extremely important here is that there are two reasons why you talk about these things and why you build bomb shelters. One is one is sort of intellectual excitement. Another is if it happens, this will help you survive it and continue. And the third is if you show that you're prepared, the other side is less likely to strike you. So it's sort of the same reason why you have large nuclear weapons. If all of your kids are trained to go under desks, there's a little bit of uncertainty on the other side, in the Soviet side, whether they should actually attack us. And this was something that was very important to a lot of people and was very important to the Soviets and something they worked on as well.
What about the doomsday machine? Did people in our government know all about it?
They didn't know anything about it. And some, you know, I present the document showing that this was built to people from the Reagan administration. So we had no idea, and in fact, we still don't believe it. One of the most interesting things about this doomsday machine is that the Soviets didn't tell us. in Dr. Strangelove, the Soviet.
So this wasn't a typical example of MED.
No, not at all. This was an object of self-deterrence. The point of the doomsday machine and the reason why it was built the way it was so the Soviets wouldn't do what is called launch on false warning, right? So this is, remember, this goes online in the early 80s where the Soviets are run by these geriatric, very old men who couldn't make quick decisions. And let's say something came over the radar and it said, American nuclear bombs have launched at us. They might think, oh my gosh, we have to decide in 5 minutes whether to strike back. But if you have this doomsday machine, then you can wait. Then you can determine whether they really are bombs or whether they're geese.
So they weren't going to trust George C. Scott to make that decision. I want to thank the two of you so much for being with us. We've been talking about some of the, can I call them terrible ideas from the Cold War? With Alexis Madrigal and Nicholas Thompson of Wired Magazine. Mr. Thompson is also the author of the book The Hawk and the Dove. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.